Welcome to Statewide, and ahead this hour, there's a lot of dissatisfaction when it comes to where the state is heading. A new survey lays out the numbers.
We asked people whether they think things in Illinois are moving in the right direction or whether they're off on the wrong track. And so 75% are saying that things are on the wrong track.
We'll also learn what likely voters think about other topics and issues facing the state. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, columnist Charlie Wheeler will join us to give some budget advice to whichever candidate wins the governor's race. One of those running for the office, Libertarian Cash Jackson.
We can respectfully disagree and leave it at that. We don't need to pass legislation forcing our belief system on the rest of society. And that's what Republicans and Democrats try and do.
Conversation with Jackson, that's ahead. Our series on energy continues with a look at solar power in the state, and we hear how some are keeping baseball the way it used to be played. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford, and thanks for being with us this week. We're going to talk more about a survey of issues and how likely Illinois voters feel about them. And we'll hear some budget suggestions for the winner of the governor's race. But first up, we'll hear from one of the candidates for governor, Libertarian Grayson Cash Jackson. He sat down with our Rachel Otwell to talk more about his campaign.
So what inspired me to run? It was really my family law case. What I've experienced over 4 years of litigation, fighting to be a father to my children, realizing that the country that I had defended wasn't really the nation that I believed that it was. The more I went through the process and the more things that I directly experienced, the more I realized that government isn't functioning to do what's in the best interest of the people that it purports to serve. And there, I saw a tremendous amount of impropriety going on directly inside the courts. That kind of led me into, of course, reaching out to other people, looking into support groups. And what I found is it's a systemic issue across the entire nation. That just segued into me opening up other doors of government and saying, well, what are they doing over here in criminal justice? How are they behaving and treating people over here? And I began to really realize there's a lot of unconstitutional legislation that has been passed that is on the books. It's quote unquote law. And I'm like, this, we got to be able to do better than this. And I felt that after 20 years in the military, I had the necessary skill sets and talents, and I'd garnered a tremendous amount of leadership experience in working with diverse groups of men and women, and I knew that I was capable. So I decided to throw my hat in the ring and take a long shot at it, and here we are today. I'm sitting here talking to you.
When it comes to some of the more alternative political advocacy, there's this thing called the men's rights movement. It postulates men are now being discriminated against even more than women, and family law and fathers' rights when it comes to custody is one of their top issues. So in line with this conversation, just wondering if you are at all related to that philosophy.
No, I'm not, because many people mislabel me as being a fathers' rights activist, and that's not accurate. What is accurate is that I fight for children and all parents, because I know a lot of moms, really great moms out there, that are experiencing it as well. And unfortunately, mothers fall underneath this stereotype that, well, if they don't get custody, there's something wrong with them. That alone should tell us that there is a standard, whether or not it's a written law or rule, there's a standard out there that moms get custody. Because if we're stereotyping moms for not getting custody, then what's driving that stereotype? And the stereotype is that traditionally, moms were caretakers and they receive full custody. Then they have to deal with that of people think there's something wrong with them. In reality, there's not. There's a lot of hidden things that they're unaware of. Relationships between attorneys and judges and, you know, who golfed with who. And I mean, there's just all of these things that we don't see, and we're not doing right by our families.
And we're going to get to some of the bigger picture topics here. But while we're on the subject of family law, you've been in the news over child support reports saying you weren't paying what you were ordered by the courts to pay. Bring us up to speed on where that stands, if you will.
Let me rewind for a minute. I have an older son in North Carolina, and you know, he and I were apart for pretty much his entire life because I was in the military, and his mom and I were separated early when he was, you know, one or two. And I paid child support on him for over 12 years with no problems. Have always supported my children. I went through the Lake County court system, and in the state of Illinois, at that time, they said, okay, well, you have two children. That's going to be 28% of your income. But then they add on child care and extracurricular activities on top of that. So I already had a $500 support order, was paying it, had paid it for over 12 years, no problem. But now when they impose this 28% plus childcare plus extracurricular activities, in effect, that meant I had to relinquish 40% of my income beginning that day that the order was entered. The average American citizen cannot lose 40% of their income overnight and pay their bills. They can't do it. And I told the judge, I'm going to see you for contempt because you're telling me I have to turn over 40% of my income and I can't afford it. But I said, you know what? What I will do, I'll do childcare 5 days a week. I'll pick them up from school. I'll take them to activities. I'll do homework. I'll feed them dinner. Mom doesn't have to do anything. I'll drop them off to her house after I've done it all, and she can just put them to bed. And the judge said no. As a result, I began falling behind. Immediately, I began falling behind. And I fell thousands of dollars behind. And because when you take that much of somebody's income, you have placed an undue burden on them. And here's what a lot of people don't consider. When the family parts ways, what the state attempts to do is ensure the children are living the same lifestyle they were living when the parents were together, correct? Well, can the average American family right now, can they take on a second mortgage or second rent, the average family? No, they cannot. And so with no increase in income, no increase in salary whatsoever, that's what's happening because now dad or mom, whomever, now has to pay their own rent and their own utilities. Where I get aggravated is we're not providing the same lifestyle for those children where they had at one time equal access to both parents, and now they don't. Why are we only talking about the money part, and we're not talking about what's most important? That's time with their parents. Illinois doesn't care about that because what it does do is it drives up litigation because then you're continuously drug in and out of court for contempt, and that's more money for attorneys and more time in front of judges, and it just continues to drive that cottage industry known as family law. So they don't really care whether or not you can pay it. They don't care if you live on the streets. They could care less.
I'm Rachel Otwell, and I'm speaking with Grayson Cash Jackson, who is the nominee for the Libertarian Party for governor in the state of Illinois. So we've touched on some of the things that have happened in your life, being a veteran, having to go to court over custody battles, and how those things have influenced your perspective. You are a libertarian, of course. And while I realize it's a pretty basic question, if you could just tell us what that means exactly and why that party appeals to you.
It really has to do with the fact that we believe in individual rights. Your right as an individual to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The current political atmosphere that we have is one that says you have to choose A or B, okay? You either got to be on this conservative team or you have to be on this liberal team. And libertarians believe you can be whoever the heck you want. We don't really care. But understand that your rights end where my rights begin. And that is respecting the right of the individual. And that's really, in essence, what moderates and independents are, which is the majority of Illinois. They're just pragmatic people who say, I don't really care how you live. Live however you want. Just don't make me live like that. I don't mind paying some taxes, but whatever you take from me, spend it responsibly. It's really kind of that simple of, look, we don't want a large government. We think that a minimal style of government is okay. Exactly what that looks like, I think, really depends on your population size and things to that effect. In large part, libertarianism is just, it's not liberal. A lot of people get us confused. They say, they hear libra and they think liberal. Well, we're liberal, but only on freedom. We want you to be free to live. Now, why is that appealing? Well, it's very appealing because I've got people that are voting for me and supporting me, not just because they're not happy with the other two candidates, but because they're realizing, wait, that's really how it should be. It really should be that I get to live how I want to live and my neighbor can live how he or she wants to live, and that's okay. We can respectfully disagree and leave it at that. We don't need to pass legislation forcing our belief system on the rest of society. And that's what Republicans and Democrats try and do. They want to force legislation, tell you how to live, tell your neighbors how to live. And if you don't agree, well, you're wrong. Because look here, we have a piece of legislation signed in a law that says we're right. No, I mean, at one time, slavery was legal. At one time, women couldn't vote. That was legal. Legal does not equal moral. So we have to make that distinction. And more people are waking up to it. And that's why I have people that supported me that voted for Trump, voted for Bernie, voted for Hillary. The whole spectrum, people are coming in droves to the campaign.
So we've touched on some of your background and how that's inspired where you're at right now as far as the things you believe in and that you'll be fighting for and are fighting for. Broadly here, what are some of the most important issues facing the state as you see it?
On a statewide level, the number one issue is our fiscal crisis. That's what is affecting every single citizen in some way, shape, or form. We have anywhere from $130 to $250 billion in unfunded pensions, depending on which credit agency calculates it and what they calculate it into. We can take the conservative figure of $130 billion of unfunded pensions. There's our greatest elephant in the room that we have to deal with right here, right now. My solutions for that, we need to go ahead and do what the state university retirement system has been doing for over 20 years. Open up a 401k or 403b style, allow government employees right now to opt into it if they choose. Now, let me be clear. I didn't say mandate. Okay, I don't want the state to mandate this. But I think that our Tier 2 employees would find it very attractive because they understand, while it may be ingrained in our Constitution that we have to pay these, if the money isn't there 10, 15, 20 years down the road when they retire, the money's not there. So it can be constitutional all day long. But if we don't have the revenue necessary to pay these pensions and we're bankrupt, okay, we've got a great piece of paper that says we're supposed to pay it to you, but we have no money to give it to you. And that's going to be an unfortunate reality if we don't change course right now. So open it up right now to all state employees, give them all the option. And then we need to work towards passing that legislation to enroll all new state hires into a defined contribution plan.
The platform on your website promises, quote, to make living in Illinois affordable for middle-class residents by controlling spending and taxes. What dollar amount could we expect to see you propose cutting in your first budget proposal?
I don't have a dollar figure, to be honest with you. And I mean, that definitely takes a tremendous amount of analysis to work towards. And that's going to take a lot of people that are a lot smarter than me to find that exact figure. And in there, you said the taxes, right? It's on my website. That is the largest driver of the outflux of citizens out of this state. Our property taxes are entirely too high. I live in Lake County. We have the highest effective property tax rate in the state, 17th highest in the nation. And I'm personally affected by it. I purchased a home in 2009. My taxes were $4,500. When I sold it in 2015, they had nearly doubled to $9,000, just short of $9,000. It's absolute insanity what people are having to spend, and it's immoral. When we've got citizens living on fixed incomes, and they've been responsible, they pay their houses off, and now they're looking at losing their home because they're on a fixed income, they're retired, and they can't afford $800, $900, $1,000 a month in property tax, that's a problem. And we have to really restructure our property taxes. Well, what is property tax fund? Primarily education. So anywhere from 60 to about 70% goes to fund education. And I want to see education, especially teacher salaries and pensions, begin to be funded on a local level. Let the local level decide what they can afford to pay their teachers and what type of pensions they can afford to give them, because the current state of affairs, we just can't keep up. And I think in large part, it's due to the excessive school districts that we have. Now, let me be clear for your listeners out there that I'm not talking about consolidating physical buildings and busing students, especially in rural Illinois, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the administrative overhead. Paying administrators these ridiculous six-figure salaries, seven-figure pensions. I want all teachers to be paid well. I want administrators to be paid well. But I think we've went beyond the point of paying well, and we've really gotten into where we're paying ridiculous amounts of money. And as a result, we don't have teachers and students and programs receiving the funding that they should be. I would rather we hired 10 more teachers and one less administrator. That's just a figure I'm throwing out. But I would like the money to go where it needs to be. We need strong programs in our schools that offer a variety of benefits to our students, and so that our parents have more options and for their children to be able to choose from different programs, where we can hire on more teachers where they're understaffed. We can't do that at current levels of funding, and a lot of this is on a local level. The governor should not be dictating and mandating down on a local level what they're paying their teachers or their administrators. That's not the governor's job, okay? My job is to ensure that every student across Illinois receives the same funding. That's what I want to ensure on a statewide level I'm doing, that we're treating every student fairly. If every student across Illinois, for example, gets $12,000, I'm doing my job. Now, on a local level, it's going to be their job. If they want additional revenue to go towards education or something, they should be doing that. But the property tax burden, that is our largest problem in our state. So I would like to begin with a 5-year property tax freeze, allow people's wages to kind of begin to catch up, kind of reduce the effect of that high property tax on their family. And then I would like to also incorporate a 2-3 voter referendum statewide. Local officials are raising taxes and they're attempting to generate additional revenue on their local economy, and they can't afford it. And the people oftentimes are not getting a choice. They're not getting a say in that. And I want them to have the say. If the majority of the populace, 66%, says, yeah, hey, we can afford that, good to go, then they can raise taxes because the majority of the citizens feel it's affordable and that they can handle it. And then if they want to allocate those additional resources towards education, that's up to them. They can go ahead and do that.
That's the Libertarian candidate for Illinois Governor, Grayson Cash Jackson. He spoke with our Rachel Otwell. For more of that conversation, including why he changed his name and his thoughts on marijuana and the Me Too movement, head to our website, that's statewideshow.com. Next week, we'll hear from the nominee of the Conservative Party, Sam McCann. We've also offered the Republican and Democratic candidates for governor a chance to join us for a conversation. We'll let you know if they accept the invitation. Just ahead, Charlie Wheeler has some budget advice for the winner of the governor's contest. That's coming up on Statewide. We're back on Statewide. We'll learn about efforts to buy into solar power in Illinois. That's still ahead. The next governor of Illinois will have to deal with the fiscal problems plaguing the state. So far, the major party candidates on the ballot, Democrat J.B. Pritzker and Republican incumbent Bruce Rauner, have failed to offer many details. For our Illinois Issues segment, Daisy Contreras talked with the columnist Charlie Wheeler about what each candidate has suggested and if their plans will actually work.
Well, the governor and the Democratic legislative leaders and rank-and-file lawmakers all agree that the budget that they put in place for the current fiscal year, the one that ends June 30th, this coming June 30th, is balanced in the sense that the state's main checkbook account will have more money coming into it than will be going out. And they are correct on paper if you assume that all of their assumptions are going to turn out to be correct. And the documents that were prepared show a ending balance of $11 million. This is on a budget that is a general funds budget, which is the state's main checkbook account, that figures bringing in about $40 billion and spending almost $40 billion, saving $11 million. Which is really a drop in the bucket. And so the assumptions include things like, well, we're going to be able to sell the Thompson Center in Chicago, and we'll realize $270 million profit. Well, this is the third time that selling the Thompson Center has been included in a budget, ostensibly to help balance the budget. The budget also assumes that we'd be able to save darn near $400 million from people like myself and like yourself, who are covered by the state by the state university's retirement system, choosing to take a buyout and accept upfront some portion of the benefits that we would be entitled to when we retire. The theory being that with this upfront payment, we'll get rid of a lot of the unfunded liability and we'll have to set aside less year after year.
Now, Charlie, let's get into what each of the candidates have outlined as possible solutions. On one side, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner has talked about a solution where raising taxes is not an option. Yet the current budget benefits from some of the revenue generated by a tax increase from last year. What does Governor Rauner suggest should be done in this case?
It would be fair to say that the governor's mantra has been, we have to improve our business climate. We have to have economic growth. We have to create more jobs. We have to entice companies to invest in Illinois, to expand what they have now, to bring new operations into the state. His specifics involve things that I think would be difficult to get through a democratically controlled General Assembly. I mean, he hasn't been able to do it for the last 4 years, and I'm not sure that his chances would be any better in the next four were he to be elected. But a lot of it involves around lowering the cost for manufacturers by weakening organized labor. One of the things he proposed earlier on was to allow Illinois to become a right-to-work state, as is Wisconsin, as is Indiana. The kind of major hurdle that I think the governor was overlooking was that in both Indiana and Wisconsin, the legislators that created the right-to-work status in both of those states were dominated by Republicans, and you had a Republican governor. Now, if Republicans controlled the General Assembly, there would be a chance for right-to-work to pass. Although in Illinois, there are a lot of union members who are Republican. There are Republican lawmakers who have solid union support in their districts, particularly downstate, and I'm thinking it would be hard to get them to go along with it.
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras, and I'm talking to Charlie Wheeler about his latest column where he walks us through the fiscal problems Illinois is currently facing and what the gubernatorial candidates have suggested they do to fix the issues. Democratic candidate J.B. Pritzker says we should change our flat tax system to a graduated or progressive income tax where higher levels of income would be taxed at higher rates. Pritzker, who is a Hyatt Hotel heir, has said he'd be willing to pay those higher rates and has suggested Governor Rauner should also be willing to do the same. Yet Pritzker has not offered any details to his progressive income tax plan. Why would this plan also not offer any immediate results?
Well, I suspect one of the reasons is, as he says, because he wants to negotiate with legislative leaders to see what they could get through. Another reason might be because whatever rate he put out there, the governor and his allies would begin to criticize immediately. And the governor also claimed that every state that has a graduated income tax, people pay more. Well, independent fact checkers have looked at that, and the answer is no, that's not true. The governor is... they said that's false. As a matter of fact, if you look at the actual data, it shows that depending on how you structure it, middle-income Illinoisans could save a lot of money if we adopted the same structure as other states. The thing that you have to take into account is that if there is a top rate, say, of 9% on millionaires, that doesn't mean that the millionaire pays 9% on every one of those $1 million. He would pay 9% on only the first dollar above a million. And so you have to look at what the income levels are, where the different rates would kick in. You also have to look at what kind of exemptions and deductions would be built into it. So as I say, it's really complicated. You can't really explain all of that in a 30-second ad. Pritzker, for example, suggested that maybe we should think of a different way to tax vehicles to provide money to keep up our roads. The gas tax, on which we relied for, I guess, going back to the 1920s, doesn't provide revenues sufficient to cover the costs of maintaining our bridges and highways. You look at the advent of electric cars, you look at hybrids, you look at better mileage, and so the gas tax, which is a flat 19 cents a gallon, is not growing the same way the inflationary costs of building roads are. And so the suggestion has been made, and some states are studying it, well, maybe rather than a gas tax, maybe we should do it on the basis of mileage. If I have an electric car, I don't pay any gas tax. If there was a way to measure my responsibility based on the miles that I have driven, then I would be paying something. But just the mere fact that Pritzker would raise the idea, well, maybe we have to think outside the box. Maybe we have to consider new ideas. Maybe something like a miles driven tax might make sense. Immediately brings this negative reaction from Rauner. So I guess I can see why Pritzker doesn't want to lay out the details for fear that they would be giving ammunition for the governor to attack him.
There are also ideas offered where legalizing recreational marijuana use or expanding gaming could bring in some revenue. These are outside from what both Rauner and Pritzker have proposed in their campaigns.
Yeah, and there have been a number of suggestions advanced over the years from groups that have said, in addition to holding the spending level, the growth in spending to roughly 2% over the next decade or so, maybe we have to look at different revenue sources. Maybe we should consider expanding the sales tax base to include certain consumer services. And we could bring in, depending on how many consumer services, we could bring in hundreds of millions of dollars that way. Or maybe we should tax retirement income. We're one of the, I believe, three states only that don't tax any retirement income at all, of the states that have an income tax. That could bring in additional money, maybe a couple billion dollars. Those proposals aren't going to be popular because they involve imposing additional costs on people who are unwilling, largely, to bear the burden. On the other hand, the ideas that you suggested, for example, legalizing marijuana, that would only tax people who choose to use marijuana. And if you regulated it, as we do alcohol, with licensing the production, overseeing it, licensing the sales, taxing them, strict regulation, you could generate hundreds of millions of dollars. Or another example would be the talk that's going around, as it has for years, of expanding gaming, adding additional casinos, allowing the existing riverboats to add new gaming positions, maybe allowing slot machines, video games at racetracks. This would not bring in a whole lot of additional money on an annual basis based on an analysis from the legislative budget analyst at the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, but it could bring in a substantial amount of one-time revenue. For example, what might we be able to get were we to auction off the right to have a casino in downtown Chicago? I would think that would be in the hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue. Again, it would only be one-time revenue because you can't do it over and over, but that would still be a help. And if you add in the fantasy sports betting, which has been floating around in recent years, the notion that we should maybe legalize this online fantasy stuff, which is very popular these days. You see the ads for the football now that we're into the football season. That would be a way to bring in money. And all those ideas involve getting funds from people who are willing to engage in the activity and therefore can't claim the state is forcing me to do this and I don't want to, but I have no choice.
Charlie Wheeler's column with some budget advice for the winner of the governor's race, that's available at statewideshow.com. Solar power has been used here and there in Illinois for a long time, but now the state is going for it in a big way. Guy Stevens has more on what's next for solar.
Well, the science boys have come up with a sunshine kick that makes electricity out of your sunlight.
Oh, yes. You mean the solar battery?
Yeah.
That's hardly even a cookie yet, let alone a cake.
Doc, that's big news.
That's from a 1954 episode of the Bell Telephone Science Hour called Our Mr. Sun. Despite the enthusiasm at that time, the technology was inefficient and expensive. It was also practical only for specialized uses like powering space satellites. Fast forward 60 years, and things are quite different. Look around and you begin to see solar arrays everywhere, powering construction signs, homes, or businesses, even those little garden lights you can buy at big box stores. And there are larger arrays.
What is new is this concept of community solar, where rather than having solar panels on your own home or business, you're subscribing to a piece of a larger project located somewhere else in your utility's service territory.
That's Anthony Starr, who heads the Illinois Power Agency. With the Future Energy Jobs Act of 2016, Illinois charted a course to boost renewable energy. The group is tasked with creating the framework for a new energy market.
So this is really, I think, the greatest unknown for us is how will this market play out?
The biggest chunk of the money allocated for renewables under the law is going to community solar. Starr says it's a lot of responsibility.
Making sure that the program works for the developers of these projects, but again, to circle back to consumer protection, a lot of money is going to be changing hands here, and it is incumbent on us to ensure that they're the appropriate consumer protection.
A good analogy might be community-supported agriculture. People who want fresh, local produce but don't have the time or space to grow it subscribe to a community farm. In return, they get boxes of in-season fruits and vegetables from the farmer they're helping to support. You don't get a box of electricity on your doorstep, but you will get a credit on your electric bill for the amount of power you've subscribed for. And if the company that runs the solar garden beats the price your utility charges, your overall cost will end up lower. It's built around what supporters call solar gardens. As the name suggests, these are smaller arrays of solar panels covering 5 to 15 acres that generate up to 2 megawatts of electricity, by one estimate enough to power 350 homes. Jim Chilson is with the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, which advocates for utility consumers. He's enthusiastic about the potential of community solar.
What CUB has found is that policies that protect the planet are also great for the pocketbook, and that's where we come in. I mean, we're a consumer group that is concerned with lowering electric bills and improving electric reliability. When you add electricity from diverse power sources, that makes the power grid more affordable and more reliable.
Ann Chilson says it goes even deeper than that.
This is a game changer in Illinois. Community solar has the potential to democratize solar power. For years, consumers have faced barriers in trying to enjoy the benefits of solar power. Community solar eliminates those barriers.
The response has been enormous. A number of solar energy businesses have been signing deals with landowners and coming to counties for zoning approvals in droves. DeKalb County held hearings for more than a dozen sites in July and August, with more on the way. And they're not alone. Andrew Barbeau is president of the Accelerate Group, an advocacy organization that helps develop and promote policies for renewables.
If you go anywhere around Tazewell County or around DeKalb or even, you know, southern Illinois near Carbondale, you talk to any farmer, they've gotten a notice, they've seen developers coming in town, they're trying to find places to build renewable energy, and that's large solar farms, community solar farms, wind farms.
Barbeau says he and his colleagues have had difficulty keeping up with the numbers, but that's a good thing.
I think there's going to be close to 1,500 to 2,000 of these projects that are sprouting up around the state, probably far more than the budget for the renewable program will be able to hold, but I think that just means we'll have years and years of growth in this.
Bill French represents Sunvest Solar Incorporated, one of the companies seeking to bring community solar gardens to Illinois. He says doing so makes business sense now.
Certainly we believe it'll be viable. A couple of things have happened. One is the regulatory avenues have opened up for us to make it a little more advantageous for us to develop solar. And then secondly, solar components continue to come down in price.
Andrew Barbeau offers a dramatic illustration of that last point. Barbeau was involved in a solar energy business project in Chicago about 8 years ago. It was estimated to cost $30 million. Today, he said, that same project will cost around $4 million. Dan Jordan is with Summit Ridge Energy, another company looking to build here. His company has applied for nearly a dozen sites in DeKalb County alone. So does he also see an opportunity for growth in Illinois?
Definitely. I mean, the solar resource here is good, meaning there's good sun. There's a lot of interest. And, you know, we're getting a lot of engagement from the contractor community, which is really good. So I feel pretty confident about the market here.
You might need to do your homework when you get that letter or letters touting a particular company's product. Jim Chilson says that's where CUB will try to help, with outreach and education efforts. CUB, the Accelerate Group, and the Environmental Defense Fund have created a website, solarinthecommunity.com, that describes itself as, quote, a matchmaking site for community solar developers, communities, and subscribers, where people can find out how to subscribe, compare plans, and even propose their own community projects. Anthony Starr with the Illinois Power Agency says it won't be the Wild West. Despite the flurry of proposals counties are dealing with now, there will be a strict set of guidelines.
I am really excited that Illinois, you know, will go from being a kind of a sleepy state on solar to one of the states where, you know, we're up there in the top set of states in terms of the amount of solar being installed in our state.
The Illinois Power Agency plans to open the process in November, with the first applications being considered early next year. So solar gardens could start going up across Illinois as spring planting begins. And like farmers, their backers are looking for a profitable harvest for businesses and consumers alike. I'm Guy Stevens.
Stay with us. We have more of Statewide just ahead. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This week saw the release of data from the University of Illinois Springfield NPR Illinois Survey of Issues. Matt Case is the research manager at the Survey Research Office at UIS. He oversaw that work, and he joins us now. Matt, explain how this was conducted. I know there was an effort to get a balance of the population included.
Sean, absolutely. So what we were aiming for was a representative sample of registered voters in Illinois. So we were really trying to get the views of those people who were going to show up and vote.
So some of the news that came out of this was regarding the governor's race, and it seemed to follow what we've seen in some other polling, which has the Democrat J.B. Pritzker ahead of the Republican governor Bruce Rauner, a double-digit lead. That's been similar to some other polling. There were two other candidates, Libertarian, Conservative Party. Several people saying they're going to vote for another candidate. Those were not specifically included. I know some people had questioned that. Why was that done that way?
You know, it was not something that we were looking at doing when we put the survey together. You know, we were really looking to look in depth at issues that were affecting Illinoisans. And at the time, I don't think that anybody really anticipated that some of these candidates would generate maybe the level of interest that they are currently. So, you know, looking back, I think maybe we would have included those candidates on the survey question.
Now, there were quite a few people who say they were are still undecided in this race, nearly over a quarter of the people. Is that uncommon for this type of survey?
No, I don't think so. In fact, there were a lot of undecideds in some of the other surveys that have been conducted on the governor's race here in Illinois. So, you know, this time, I mean, there are really a lot of people that are just not ready to choose a candidate. We're seeing that, I think, more on the Republican side than on the Democratic side. So, for instance, Democrats are just a lot more rallied around their candidate, J.B. Pritzker, than the Republicans are rallied around Rauner. And an interesting point there also is that the two third-party candidates, which we did not survey on, those are both coming from the right. So we have Sam McCann in the Conservative Party and then also Cash is in the Libertarian Party.
I think the one thing that I took away from an overall a point of view from reading the results of the survey, it seemed to be just dissatisfaction in the state of Illinois by people. There were half the people saying they have considered leaving the state. There was a lot of people who said, you know, term limits are needed. So that kind of proves they're probably not that happy with the way government operates. There just seemed to be this overall view that things are not on the right track.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Sean. So we asked people whether they think things in Illinois are moving in the right direction or whether they're off on the wrong track. And so 75% are saying that things are on the wrong track. In addition, about half of people, over half, 53%, are saying that they've considered leaving the state. And that's a lot certainly more true with younger individuals we surveyed. So, for instance, over two-thirds, 67% of those 35 younger than 35 years old have considered leaving.
And, of course, younger folks are probably more mobile. Maybe they don't have as many ties to the area. They may not own, possibly may not even own property in the state at that point. So getting up and moving might be a little bit easier for somebody than that is younger than it is for somebody that's a bit older.
Yeah, absolutely so. I mean, you know, when you look at people that are, you know, over 65, I mean, not many of those people are considering leaving just because, as you said, they're kind of tied to the state.
So as far as some of the key issues in here, one was the graduated income tax. There was a question regarding whether or not people support that idea. That would tax people who make more money at a higher income tax rate. Right now, Illinois has the flat tax, but this has come up in the governor's race. This has been an issue that's getting a lot of attention of whether this so-called progressive or graduated income tax should be something that the state should go to. And we're seeing that there is support for that, at least among a segment of the population.
57% of those that we surveyed say they're favoring graduated income tax, which we defined as, you know, people at higher levels of income being taxed at higher rates. And then 36% are favoring the current flat rate tax system. But, you know, so that means also that there are some that we're not sure undecided. But we're also seeing that so majorities of both Democrats and independents favor this system. So about 70% of Democrats and 56% of independents favor that graduated income tax. And even a good minority of Republicans do. 40% of those are favoring that graduated income tax. So there seems to be a pretty wide appeal on that.
And 57% of the respondents overall say that they favor it. However, to put this into the state constitution, if that's the way it has to be done, changing the constitution would take 60% of the population to weigh in on that. It would have to get on the ballot first. So it's still not a done deal by any stretch, and not a gimme that this thing will actually ever become law.
You're absolutely right, and there's certainly not a mandate from what we can see in our survey, though a majority are saying that they favor a graduated income tax system. It's not a very strong majority, and we would really want to do some more surveying and look at what other people have to say about the issue.
We're talking with Matt Case. He's the research manager at the UIS Survey Research Office. We're talking about the Illinois Issues Survey involving the UIS and also NPR Illinois. It came out this week. Going into some other issues that were discussed in this, one of these issues involved guns that popped up in this survey, and I thought was kind of interesting. Almost, 90% of the people saying that mental health background checks should be required for gun purchases?
Almost 90%, right? 89% are favoring mental health background checks for all gun purchases, and that includes 87% of Republicans. So, you know, really there seems to be just, you know, unanimous approval of that measure.
And yet it seems as though when this issue comes up, there is quite a bit of public debate, not just among lawmakers and others. That seems to be in the public as well. Do you think this is an accurate sampling of truly how people feel on this issue?
I do, actually, because it's very close to what other surveys are finding. And I can say that there is broad support across party lines for mental health background checks. And most people that have looked at this issue have found that.
So let's look at some other topics that are in this as well and questions that were asked of people. What stood out to you? What were some of the others that seemed to jump out to you?
Well, I certainly think immigration. We asked some questions about immigration in the survey, and just the distance between Democrats and independents on the one hand and Republicans on the other is quite remarkable. So while more than three times as many are likely to say they think immigrants help Illinois rather than hurt it, only a minority of Republicans believe this. So only 36% are saying that immigrants are helping the state and making it a better place. And so that's really only the case with Republicans. And another thing that really stood out to me was just on higher education. Just there was a lot of, I think, distance between individuals in support for school vouchers and support for making kindergarten compulsory at age 5. It's currently age 6. Those with lower incomes, those living in Chicago, those from minority ethnic backgrounds are a lot more supportive of these programs than their counterparts.
And of course, something I noticed when I looked at this survey regarded the media. There seems to be a lack of faith in the media, not just as I think maybe some people might think Republicans, especially those who have supported Donald Trump, might feel as though that the media is not always fair. Democrats were not overwhelmingly saying that the media is doing a good job either.
No, there's not a lot of trust in the mass media right now, although certainly Democrats are more trusting than Republicans are. It's interesting when you look at it that way. One interesting crosstab that we did is we looked at those who say they trust Fox News the most, so that's their most trusted news source. And so only 23% of those are saying they trust the mass media, whereas for those who are watching CNN, 76% say this. So that's more than three times as many of CNN viewers compared to Fox News viewers trust the media.
And, of course, independents. I think less than half of those said they trust the mass media. So it's Republicans and maybe those that don't necessarily fall along either party line who have some concerns when it comes to what they see, what they read.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of other polls that are out there are finding this to be the case as well. Trust in the media has just really plummeted since the election of Donald Trump. It's really just dropped precipitously. And so I think that so long as you see the Trump administration say these negative things about media, then people that are supporters of Trump are going to have a negative view and say that they cannot trust the mass media.
Another question in there regarded whether or not we are divided when it comes to politics and race, and I believe the terminology used in this was almost all of those surveyed say they were very divided or somewhat divided over politics, and pretty close to the same number saying the same thing about when it comes to racial issues. I don't know if this is a surprise to those who do watch the news and hear different things, you know, watch social or view social media, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the impetus, you know, behind doing the survey was to look at the differences on partisan lines and also look at independents. And really everybody is saying that we're polarized in this country. We're just very far apart from one another, whether it's what we're how we're getting our news or, you know, whatever it is that we're doing. And, you know, I'm not surprised by the findings, but perhaps I'm a bit disappointed.
Have you done those types of surveys before? Have you asked those types of questions in the past? And if you have they, you know, how would this compare to that?
Well, I can't think of asking this specific question in the past, but I do know that what a lot of researchers are finding now is that we are definitely more polarized now than we used to be, and it's getting worse if it possibly can.
That's Matt Case. He's the research manager at the University of Illinois Springfield Survey Research Office. You can find the full results of the state survey at statewideshow.com. While there, you can also check out our past shows featuring reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. As Major League Baseball heads toward the postseason, it's a good time to reflect on the role that the game plays in American history. It's been around for a long time, but the rules have changed.
Come on, A-Stack.
Hey, there you go, Stack! Yay!
Lizzie Roars introduces us to the Rock Springs Ground Squirrels, who play the old-fashioned way.
Well, the Ground Squirrels are a vintage baseball team. Now, this is a group of people who play by the old original rules of baseball. The Ground Squirrels actually play by the rules of 1858.
That's Lee Slider. He's the founder of the Rock Springs Ground Squirrels, a baseball team in Decatur, Illinois, that prefers the rules of yesterday to the hustle and flair of modern games.
We've been, my goodness, we've been in existence here at Rock Springs Center in Decatur since 1993. I got a phone call from a friend of mine who works for the Ohio Historical Society there in the summer of 1993. And he says, we have a flat spot in our schedule. Could you get a bunch of guys and come over and play vintage baseball?
And play they did. That game in Ohio was just the beginning for the Rock Springs Ground Squirrels. Of course, Slider never expected that first game to turn into what is now the 25th season for the team.
We had a fellow who was playing who was from the Wall Street Journal. And they stuck him on our team. September, the Wall Street Journal came out with a story of that game and a picture above the fold. The next thing I knew, we were featured in a Southwest Airlines in-flight magazine. Then I started getting phone calls.
The interest in vintage baseball was growing fast, which meant it was time for the Rock Springs Ground Squirrels to become an official team.
And then we started doing exhibitions for centennial, town centennials, and we would get pickup teams. And then one of them figured that they would... They liked the game so much that they start their own club. And that was the Atwood Mudcats. But after that, clubs start showing up.
Today, there are dozens of vintage ball clubs in the Midwest, but Slider says the Ground Squirrels can't take all the credit for the sport's surge in popularity.
The Ohio Village Muffins. They're the ones who really started us and that club in Indiana. And it spread from there. We You know, we were kind of like prophets in the wilderness, as it were.
This marked the 25th year for the Rock Springs Ground Squirrels. They're based in Decatur. Lizzie Roars with that report. Glad you can be with us for another edition of Statewide, and we'll be back again next week with more. We hope you can join us then. You can also find our podcast each week at NPR One. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois and other Illinois public radio stations.